From RT's special studio in Beijing, Vladimir Putin's trip to China winds down with the Russian leader praising global efforts to bring the world to multipolarity.
After all, when we talk about multipolarity, this does not mean that a new hegemon should appear. No one raises questions like this, neither within the SCO nor within the framework of BRICS. All participants in international communication should have equal rights. And everyone should be in the same position from the point of view of international law.
China's state-of-the-art weaponry was center stage at the Grand Military Parade in Beijing, and Xi Jinping led the ceremonies marking the 80th anniversary of China's victory over Japanese occupation in World War II.
Only when all countries and nations treat each other as equals, coexist in peace and support each other, can we uphold common security, eradicate the root cause of war, and prevent the reoccurrence of historical tragedies.
A very warm welcome to you as we continue our special coverage from the Chinese capital, Beijing. It's been a very busy few days for us here in China. And the Russian President Vladimir Putin has wrapped up his four-day trip to China now. He's met with the press. The Russian leader emphasized the importance of equality in the global political arena.
On whether or not a multipolar world has developed, in general, its contours, of course, have developed. But at the same time, I would not talk about any leaders of this multipolar world. After all, when we talk about multipolarity, this does not mean that a new hegemon should appear. No one raises questions like this, neither within the SCO nor within the framework of BRICS. All participants in international communication should have equal rights. And everyone should be in the same position from the point of view of international law. Yes, of course, there are economic giants such as India and China. By the way, our country is among the four largest countries in the world in terms of purchasing power parity. But this does not mean that someone should dominate the political or any other sphere, including security. Therefore, we are not operating under the assumption that new dominant states should appear. Everyone should be equal.
Well, our correspondent was at that press briefing with the Russian president, and he's here with me now. Igor Zhdanov, thank you for running on over to join me in our little studio. It's been such a busy few days for us, hasn't it? I mean, so much has happened, and then it all ended with this big press conference with the Russian president. Just take us through some of the key statements made.
Yeah, first we have a military parade. Now we have like a political parade straight from the big guy. Vladimir Putin, indeed, some very, very few busy days here. Just a quick reminder, of course, you followed it with me together. First, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit. I mean, lots of people, lots of world leaders, lots of topics to discuss. Then he moved on here to Beijing. He continued the meetings. I mean, he met the Chinese Supreme Leader, Xi Jinping, in Tianjin. That's where the summit was held. Then he met with him here. He met all sorts of his counterparts. He met with India, with Pakistan, with Congo, with, I mean, the list can really go on. He met with Fico, among the, you know, the Prime Minister of Slovakia, a NATO member state and part of the EU. So, yeah, very busy days. I mean, the whole night probably wouldn't be enough for us to cover everything, just to wrap it all up. But luckily, Vladimir Putin did it all for us. He wrapped it up in the media conference that I was part of. So essentially, the questions, of course, they ranged from geopolitical local, being tethered to the current affairs, to what he was talking about in Beijing, who he met, what he talked about. But also, of course, I mean, none of us journalists could ignore the big elephant in the room, and that's the situation in Ukraine. Because even here, even in China, he did raise the subject of peace in Ukraine. It was raised repeatedly by Vladimir Putin's vis-a-vis and so on. So As journalists, we couldn't ignore it either. And one of the questions was about the potential meeting between Vladimir Putin and Zelensky, because so far, Russia's position has been, well, it has been straightforward, but without any details. Like, the meeting is possible, but first, some favorable conditions should be met and for this meeting in order to be productive. Now, Vladimir Putin, he gave an insight and a little bit into the way he thinks about it, his thought process in it. So, long story short, Zelensky's authority, basically his right to be president, they ran out after the five-year term. Of course, there's a war going on in the country, so the elections, they can't be held. So in order to hold these elections, Zelensky has to hold these elections, he should drop the military regime inside the country, inside Ukraine. So essentially, he has to hold a referendum before any decisions are made, because he's already saying he will be agreeing to, you know, a territory swap, a land swap, but the constitution doesn't allow it, so he has to hold a referendum. And then it's already a complicated situation enough, but this gets even worse the more you dig, the more you fall down into this rabbit hole of Ukraine's internal political life, the worse it gets. You can hear it from the man himself.
As for possible meetings with Mr. Zelensky, I have never ruled out the possibility of such a meeting. In the end, if Zelensky is ready, let him come to Moscow. Such a meeting will take place. Is there any sense in these meetings? There is a provision according to which elections are not held under martial law. But this does not mean that the powers of the president are prolonged. This means that his powers have expired. His rights are transferred to the Speaker of the Parliament. What should the current authorities do then? If they want to be legitimate, they have to hold a referendum in accordance with the Constitution of Ukraine. But a referendum cannot be held under martial law. Martial law must be lifted. But as soon as this is done, they need to go to the polls, then get the relevant opinion of the Constitutional Court. But how to get a ruling from the Constitutional Court? If, after the authorities demanded that the Constitutional Court of Ukraine confirm the prolonged powers of the president, it actually refused to do so. Do you know what they did in Ukraine? It's funny, but true. The guard stopped letting the chairman of the Constitutional Court into his workplace. That's it. That's how it all ended. Therefore, this is a path to nowhere. To put it carefully, you can just hold meetings with the current head of the administration. I have never refused to do this. If this meeting is well prepared and will lead to some positive possible results.
Yeah, it does feel like a face-to-face meeting between Vladimir Putin and Zelensky would be a positive step in the right direction towards peace. And Vladimir Putin has said himself, you know, Zelensky, come on over to Moscow. Let's have a meeting. Let's make it happen. Is the Russian leader signaling that an end to the conflict is in sight, though? I know that that was one of the questions from one of the reporters.
Yeah, absolutely. And once again, Vladimir Putin talked about how this whole thing could have been over back in 2022. And that, as he revealed, as he said himself, apparently for the first time, he made it part of the public domain. So what happened behind the closed doors, as the Russian forces were literally camping just outside the city limits of Kiev, he got calls from leaders of Europe, of the United States, and there was progress, after all, being made, first in Minsk, then in Istanbul. And Europe and the United States, collectively, they were ringing up Vladimir Putin, his aides, his, you know, right-hand men, and they were saying, look, just pull out of Kiev, and that would be like a gesture of goodwill. According to Vladimir Putin, that's what Russia did, because, well, it did. I was there. I was also with the Russian troops just outside of Kiev, and we were about to have like another shoot. We were about to go and shoot some report, and late in the evening we see the news. We see Russia withdraws troops from the Kiev region. We all think, well, what is going on? So we realize that. That's it. Our work there is done. And the whole Russian tactical group, well, pulls out as a gesture of goodwill. But what happened later, Vladimir Putin has said, is his European partners all of a sudden took a very different stance. And they said, well, okay, now we're fighting to the bitter end. It's either you or us. Except, again, according to the Russian president, they used some, less diplomatic terms.
In 2022,
we offered the Ukrainian authorities to respectfully consider the choice of the people living in southeastern Ukraine. We suggested withdrawing their troops from there and ending the conflict immediately. I must say that this was not entirely rejected. However, after we withdrew our forces from Kyiv at the persistent requests of our Western European colleagues, the situation changed, and we were told almost verbatim that they would continue to fight until either they tore our heads off or we did it to them. And so it continues. Nevertheless, it seems to me that if common sense prevails, it is possible to agree on an acceptable option for ending this conflict. I am proceeding from this assumption, especially since we see the sentiments of the current U.S. administration under President Trump. We see not just calls, but a sincere desire to find a solution. It seems to me that there is a certain light at the end of the tunnel. We will see how the situation unfolds. If not, we will have to resolve all the tasks set before us by armed means.
And after all, we all know what happened next, right? Russia was slapped by one round of sanctions after another, and it goes on to this day, really, this process. Then Russia's strategic reserves were frozen, and now there is talk. There has been talk all along, but like right now, it got like the second wind that maybe those reserves should be just, you know, taken away from Russia and spent on Ukraine, on other matters, on weapons for Ukraine to reimburse Europe and maybe the United States for all their expenses. After all, they have suffered some quite significant, you know, they budget, not budget cuts, but rather they suffered some quite significant budgeting because of Ukraine. And Vladimir Putin, of course, there are different voices in Europe and in the United States. Some are saying, yeah, we should do it. Others are saying, well, that would be a very dangerous precedent, which we shouldn't set. And it would send a very wrong signal to everyone else who right now entrusts us, Europe and the United States, as holders of their strategic reserves. And so Vladimir Putin, he addressed that, and he openly called that those people who make a push for Russia to be parted with all these funds are just silly.
Events in Ukraine are merely a pretext for addressing economic issues concerning a number of countries with which some have unsatisfactory economic ties. Countries like India, almost 1.5 billion people, and China, 1.3 billion, with powerful economies but also their own domestic political laws, are involved. You see, when someone says, "We will punish you," how should the leadership of such powerful and large countries, which have gone through very difficult periods in their history related to colonialism, and attempts over a long historical period to infringe upon their sovereignty, respond? If any of them shows weakness, then their political career is over, just like the end of the colonial era. It's impossible to speak to these partners in such a tone today. I believe that ultimately, everything will fall into place and return to the normal course of economic dialogue.
So there you have it. And of course, those were just some of the topics that Vladimir Putin talked about, speaking to us, the journalists. Like, I asked him what he talked about with Donald Trump while in the car there. Apparently that ride was, as he said, only about 30 seconds long. So they just had a friendly chat. It was no time and the wrong time and the wrong place to talk business. It was just a reconciliation moment. And they spoke in English, by the way. That's something that Vladimir Putin confirmed. Saying that while his command of the English language is rather rudimentary compared to how he maybe could do that, how he used to speak that language. But yeah, indeed, he confirmed that meeting Donald Trump, he wished him, he said that he was happy to see him alive and in good health, obviously making a reference to that assassination attempt that Trump survived during his campaign trail. Vladimir Putin, he also talked about some internal issues for Russia. He talked geopolitics, he talked trade balance. In general, it was clear that Vladimir Putin, he was tired after all these days, very busy schedule, but still he found a very big chunk of his time to talk to us. There was even a funny moment when his press secretary Peskov. He was like, maybe that should be the final question. And Vladimir Putin, he joked about he will take a few more. He will wrap up soon. And he made a joke about Peskov being too, well, you know, jumping the gun a little bit.
He called him a lazy bone. Yeah.
It was a joke, obviously. He called him a lazy bone, saying, look at him. Doesn't want to work. wants the day to be over. So yeah, it was humorous at the same time. So it wasn't like. Like a bitter event. What was also humorous is in Vladimir Putin's view, Donald Trump had to say about all these meetings between Putin, Xi Jinping, and Kim Jong-un, of course, the three leaders, Russia, China, and North Korea. Because Donald Trump, he tweeted that he wishes all the best to all these leaders as they conspire against the United States. And lots of media outlets, they took it and they presented it as if that was like a serious, like as if Trump was offended, as if he almost felt threatened by it. That's not the view of Vladimir Putin. Of course, we can only know what Trump meant by it, whether he was sarcastic or humorous about it, or whether he meant it very seriously. That's up to the big man in the White House. But according to Vladimir Putin, he said that, well, Trump has a good sense of humor, like he jokes around, and obviously he said that nobody was conspiring against the United States, and he revealed he pretty much made a bet on it almost as he was talking to us. He said that he talked to so many world leaders throughout these several days, and he said pretty much all of them expressed they were very optimistic, and they expressed very much a lot of positivity about what happened in Anchorage, Alaska, when Vladimir Putin was meeting with Donald Trump. And Putin was saying that, well, he wouldn't have revealed it if it wasn't true, because then he would look unreliable in the eyes of all the foreign partners who he talked with. So there you have it. Again, a very eventful evening, but it only makes sense after all. What do you expect following these several crazy days that we've had here, and that all the politicians, all the world leaders have as well? So yeah, this is how apparently all this wraps up.
Oh, that's a great wrap-up. Thank you very much. And I think you're right. President Putin was in very good spirits, considering how busy he's been over the past 4 days. And we've been very busy as well. So really appreciate all the reports you've been bringing us from Tianjin at the SCO, and then following President Putin to Beijing, and then wrapping it all up for us here. Igor Zhdanov, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to bring you this special coverage from China over the last few days. We've seen history made, and it's been so great that you've witnessed it together with us here on RT International. From myself and all of our team here in China, it's bye for now.
Well, China's Grand Victory Day parade wrapped up in Beijing, and President Xi Jinping led the pageantry, marking the 80th anniversary of China's victory over Japanese imperialism. Hypersonic missiles, UAVs, and next-generation tanks were on display on Tiananmen Square, while cutting-edge fighter jets soared overhead. In his opening address to the parade, the Chinese president spoke of the great sacrifices that his people made during the war, and he warned that such a conflict should never be repeated. He also thanked all the countries who aided the nation in its most difficult times.
I would like to express my sincere thanks to foreign governments and friends that supported and assisted the Chinese people in resisting aggression. I also extend a warm welcome to our guests from around the world who are with us today. The Chinese people's war of resistance against Japanese aggression was an important part of the world war against fascism. With huge national sacrifice, the Chinese people made major contributions toward saving human civilization and safeguarding world peace. History cautions us that humanity rises and falls together. Only when all countries and nations treat each other as equals, coexist in peace, and support each other, can we uphold common security, eradicate the root cause of war, and prevent the reoccurrence of historical tragedies. The Chinese nation is a great nation that is never intimidated by any bullies and always values independence while always forging ahead. Today, humanity again has to choose between peace and war, dialogue and confrontation, win-win cooperation, and zero-sum games. The Chinese people firmly stand on the right side of history and the progress of human civilization. We will remain committed to the path of peaceful development and join hands with all peoples around the world in building a community with a shared future for humanity.
In other news, the Ukrainian ambassador to the UK and former head of the armed forces there has come out with a shockingly candid admission. Valery Zaluzhny says that Russia's military know-how currently outpaces the rest of the entire world.
Today, all military science is concentrated in Russia. Let anyone argue with me who wants. And these, by the way, bans on citing Russian sources in scientific works. I don't know how they will study military science without citing them, because it's all there. Unfortunately, that's how it turned out.
Well, one of the latest breakthroughs of Russian military science is the Oreshnik missile. Its capabilities were shown in action last year in targeting Ukraine's military industrial sites. Missile strike power is similar to that of a nuclear weapon, and the Oreshnik itself can also theoretically be armed with atomic warheads. According to Russian officials, Moscow is not sitting on its laurels, and it's already begun developing weapons that far surpass that missile. But to get more on this, we're joined in the studio now by former U.S. Army officer Stanislav Krapivnik. Stanislav, it's always great having you on the program in the studio. First of all, I want to ask you about Zaluzhny's comments. Do you think they're accurate?
Always a pleasure to be here. Absolutely, they're accurate. Russia was leading in technological development before the SMO. With the SMO, all of that equipment is being was battle tested, and has been adapted further and further to reality today's technology. What we see coming in from the West is basically outdated technology. Even the most modern American M1, A2, SEP 3 tanks are basically the technology of the 90s and 2000s. They are well outdated. So yes, absolutely. And the West isn't learning as quickly. That's another thing. Just as a simple example, we saw the new American drones, which is an exact copy of the Shahid. Mm-hmm. Even the propeller, it's everything's an identical copy. And this was like a breakthrough. And it came out a couple months ago. So they're lagging. They're generationally lagging behind the bleeding edge of technology.
Yeah, it's funny, the U.S. copying technology when they accuse China of stealing U.S. technology all the time. But anyway,
yeah, exactly.
in terms of Russia's military technology, I spoke a little bit about the Oreshnik, this cutting-edge Russian ballistic missile. But excluding that, if you had to choose three top weapons that Russia's using on the battlefield that make the biggest difference, what would they be?
Well, we'll just start with, just as a category in general, hypersonic weapons. Yeah, you know, it's not enough that it has speed. It has to have maneuverability, because all ballistic missiles become, quote, hypersonic because they all hit past Mach 6 when they're coming in. But they're not maneuverable. So you can plan a formula to take them down if you have enough space and time. Hypersonics, they just move out of the way. So there's absolutely nothing right now in the West that can compete with a hypersonic. And that has them worried, because quite literally, if Russia was anything like the West, there would have been a surgical strike on Washington or on London by now. They would have done that to Russia if they had that kind of advantage. But thankfully, they don't. And they should be very thankful we're not like them, because we haven't. So that's a category all on its own. Russia is on third generation hypersonics. America's trying to get the first generation up and running and is not having a lot of success. Halo was canceled. Archer was canceled. So I don't know what exactly they're developing at the moment. So that's one. The T-90 Prariv tank, that's a fully modernized weapons platform, a very effective weapons platform. Granted, tanks aren't fighting in the same style they were before because of drones. But then anti-drone systems are coming up online, including laser systems, which right now are being fielded that take out the they can take out the drones very quickly. Basically, I think about 1 second on target, and your average four-propeller drone just disintegrates. It starts to melt. Those systems are high on the list. The Terminator is just an excellent infantry support vehicle and an anti armor vehicle. We've seen them working forests over where the Ukrainian army's dug in or are trying to maneuver through a forested area, and just one of those platforms comes up and just levels everything. Totally turns the tide. It reminds me of in World War I when Russian armored cars drove up while the Austrians were attacking infantry wave attack, and just one armored car was able to stop an infantry attack from a brigade because the machine guns would start firing and had nothing to stop the armored car with. It seems like the same thing, you know, 100 years later, and here we are, the same thing with a platform like the Terminator. So that's an excellent platform. The new artillery systems that are coming in. The coalition systems that are hitting up to 40 kilometers out, the various munitions, the drone munitions. So there's whole categories. It's hard to just pick three because they all work together, right? This is a combined arms battlefield. Yes, tanks aren't as prevalent as you would have after World War II. Technology has changed, but it's still a combined arms battlefield. So you have the artillery, the heavy artillery, the rocket-propelled artillery, like the Grads and the Tornado Uragans. But you also have the remote-controlled weapon systems that are in the air constantly searching and destroying enemy targets. And combined, I mean, what can you say? It works well. It's the top of the line. And if the West would swallow its pride, I think they are trying to copy, but they're lagging very far behind, thankfully.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely say that this should amount to a big ego boost for the Russian military, because at the same time, we've been talking about the cutting edge nature of that, but it's also going against the full force of NATO technology, which has been supporting Ukraine on the battlefield, and they still can't compete. Why do you think that is?
Well, the U.S., I can tell you straight up, the U.S. Army is a victim of its own, you could say hubris, but really of its own competence in its time period. When the U.S. military went into Iraq, it had the top bleeding edge tanks, you could say. The M1A2s were coming in. The M1A1s were the main tanks that were used. And they were very high-tech for the time, composite armor, which they got from the English, and so on. But the problem is victims of their own victory in that they said, look, you know, we're the top of the line. We don't need to spend as much money, R&D, on this or that, because there's nobody that can compete with us. And they kind of didn't notice that there were people still developing. The Russian military was developing. The Chinese were developing. And by the time they realize or they come to that realization, past all the egotism that, hey, we're behind, you're really, really behind. Mm-hmm. Just as an example, the Shtora 1, Shtora 2 system, which is the anti-missile, anti-grenade, rocket-propelled grenade system on the Russian tanks. The U.S. has one brigade with the same types of systems. They're called the Triumph. They bought from the Israelis. They didn't develop themselves. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. is now that it's starting to realize reality, and it had its eye off the ball in Afghanistan and Iraq, which they spent some like $7 trillion on those two little adventures. Got to line the pockets of the corporation somehow. Now they're trying to catch up, and they're incapable of doing it because throwing money and not having the talent, engineering talent, doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Well, we don't have too much time left, so I'd like to ask you one more question, if you could just give a short response. I mean, technology is, of course, very important, but so is strategy. And a lot of these top commanders in Ukraine were actually educated during Soviet times. Mm-hmm. The current head of Ukraine's armed forces studied at a Moscow military academy institution. So why do you think we see differences in strategy between Russia and Ukraine in the battlefield right now?
Well, first of all, so were all the Russian officers for the most part. You know, drone warfare, Russia was playing catch up on drone warfare in 22. 23, they really started catching up. 24, they are leading the edge. This is something that's been true with Russian, with the Russian military and Russian and the Soviet military for ages. Russia may start off a bit slow and even a bit behind, but it has a very high learning curve. Mm-hmm. And the generals pick it up very quickly. This is something that the Germans weren't exactly planning on in World War II. The Russian generals outperformed them very quickly once they figure out what strategies worked. And it's still the same thing. The problem with the Ukrainians, by the way, is they're not planning their own missions. Mm-hmm. NATO's planning their missions. And for the American and British generals, by the way, the Ukrainians are just meat. At the end of the day, it's not Americans and not, at least officially, it's not Americans and British dying, it's Ukrainians dying. So let's experiment the old way. If it didn't work once, it's like the World War I strategy. The first body wave didn't work, let's send in the next one, and the next one, and the next one, and the next one. They'll run out of bullets sooner or later. And that's what we've been seeing on the Ukrainian battlefield very often, when the West is planning their missions.
All right, Stanislav Krapivnik, former U.S. Army officer, thanks for joining us in the studio.
Thank you.
More news coming your way in just about 30 minutes.